Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's episode of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We have spoken about this at length in the past. Recently I chanced upon a few newspaper articles that highlighted this, that recent surveys have found that millions of self-identified Christians, disillusioned with their options in the year's elections, have actually decided not to vote at all. Some estimates going almost as far as high as almost 30% of the Christian vote. As Catholics, I need to make this very clear. We have a moral obligation to participate in our nation's politics, even though we know we will ultimately answer to a higher power than the government. In fact, I argue it is because we know that we will ultimately answer to a higher power than the government that we ought to practice our roles as Christians in the public sphere well. The right to a free and fair democratic process necessitates the moral onus of stewarding that right well. That is true of all rights, by the way. This is not just something I'm constructing in some fit of brilliance, so to speak. This is what the Church has always taught. This is not unique to me. If a right has been granted, first from God and then enshrined constitutionally within a nation or in a state, then the citizens who are given those rights are now also endowed with the moral onus of stewarding that right well. Our civic duty in voting is one such right, and we ought to think carefully about the prudential judgment of voting. We ought to discern very carefully at the federal level as we discern which candidate we lend our votes to, but also at every single juncture. We have a moral obligation, and as I've mentioned in the past, we will owe accountability to God for the people whom we cast our ballots for. So it might sound that we're just one person and therefore our ballots really don't count for much, but in the light of eternity, we have a moral accountability. We move on from there to speak with Wes Smith about honoring the legacy of anti-assisted suicide champion Rita Marker, who passed at 83. And then finally, we speak with Sue Ellen Browder about the advertising campaign that sold abortion to the United States of America. All of this we will talk about after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, November 4th. It's the Feast of St. Charles Borromeo. Today's news brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. Pope Francis's prayer intention for the month of November is for those who have lost a child. He says there are no words one can offer to someone who's lost a child because the pain is so great. The Pope explained that we need to listen to them, to be close to them with love, to care responsibly for the pain they feel, and to imitate how Jesus Christ consoled those who were afflicted. Polls are showing a tight race just ahead of the presidential election. The final NBC News poll released Sunday shows Vice President Harris and former President Trump locked in a dead heat, each candidate receiving 49% support in the national poll. It's similarly close in key swing states. Trump ads that were shown during NBC's NASCAR and NFL coverage yesterday are reportedly connected to Vice President Harris's surprise Saturday Night Live appearance. On Sunday, a FCC commissioner called Harris showing up on SNL a clear and blatant effort to evade the FCC's equal time rule. The Supreme Court is taking up the dispute over Louisiana's congressional map. The decision will not impact the election this week, but the messy legal fight could determine whether the state's map can continue in future years. The topic has turned into a battle over how to amend a racially gerrymandered design. An anti-euthanasia advocate, Rita Marker, has died at 83. Marker, a devout Catholic, founded the Patient Rights Council in the 1980s and was a guest several times on Crest in the Afternoon and Catholic Connection. Her friend Wes Smith joins us later in this hour. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My friend Doug Keck of EWTN joins me today to talk about something that's near and dear to both our hearts, which is the stewardship of civic responsibility amongst faithful Catholics in the public political sphere. Doug, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Well, thank you for inviting me. Always a pleasure. Thank you, Marcus.
So, Doug, you and I spoke about this once before, and it's something that we take for granted. Well, some Catholics can take it for granted because we can tend to believe that being Catholic means cutting ourselves off from the world. But there really is a moral onus to stewardship of civic responsibility that's part of the Catholic identity.
Absolutely. And I think, I know there's some stories out there, and you mentioned the articles and about Christians, quote unquote, not voting. And certainly in many other Christian denominations, you can talk about some of the reasons why there tends to be this kind of more dualistic separation between, you know, God's kingdom and the earthly kingdom. And we as Catholics obviously have always been called to be part of the culture. Our job is to be the salt, to change the culture, to make things better. Otherwise, we end up like the servant who takes his one talent and buries it and doesn't do anything with it. And our Lord was not particularly happy getting back what he gave you. He expects you to do something with it, and that's what we're called to do. And one of the simple things is that, you know, in Acts 14:23, they talk about how the early Christians elected elders by voting. So obviously, early in the church, the idea of selecting leaders and being involved in selecting leaders, not just necessarily sitting there and saying, we're going to wait until the Holy Spirit, you know, tells us which one of these people happens to be the person who's going to be in charge, we have to pray for that insight and then know that we are God's arms and legs in this world, and that's what we're supposed to do. And certainly as Catholics, we're certainly called to do that.
And Doug, even as you're talking, right, there is even this natural law reality that at play here, which is that the life of a democracy, especially if we're talking about a virtuous republic, that which is what we aspire to be, it simply cannot be productive, thrive, or even survive without active, consistent, responsible, generous involvement of everyone within the republic. So if a good chunk of us decide to sit back and say, well, I'm not involved, really the entire nation suffers.
Well, I think we know even the idea, first of all, the idea that it's not the things we avoid doing, it's also the things we don't do that we'll be held accountable for. Well, we understand that as a better understanding of the Ten Commandments and our Lord's teachings, where he moved away from, it's not just don't do this, but you need to do this. Okay. And so the idea that I'm not going to, it doesn't impact me, so I'm not going to get involved. First of all, you have a call as a Christian to love your neighbor. So if something's happening that's going to be negative against your neighbor, it's your obligation to stand up for that.
Yeah.
The other thing is, in the world we live in today, thinking that anybody can live a life so detached from what's going on in the world seems to be really very naive. And we've seen that it's not just a question of different things even happening in the secular world over the, you know, let's say gay marriage and things. Well, this isn't going to impact you. You're not gay. You know, they're going to just have a nice couple or whatever. The next thing you know, no, we're going to teach this in your schools and your kids need to understand this. And wait a second, when you object, well, you're a homophobe and you can't do that. And so all of these things occur, and unless you stand up at the beginning, it's been done in many ways. I always know it from the hangman's tale, the idea they came for the Jew, they came for the unionist, they came, and then they finally came for me, and there wasn't anybody to object, and it's the same thing. Over a period of time, it erodes, and suddenly you're not getting the pushback that you should, and as a Christian and as a Catholic, it's your obligation, like you said, as far as stewardship, and again, standing up for religious liberty, religious freedom. We don't want the government, one way or the other, telling Catholic churches or Catholic schools what they have to teach.
Yep. Or even Catholic individuals what they have to believe and adhere to that violates their religious sentiments.
Right. Exactly.
So let's talk about the last time I heard you speak at the radio conference. As you were talking, one of the things that made me wake up was this notion of how our consciences really have to be subject to the truth that has been revealed in Christ and His Church. And that comes into play here when we're talking about our prudential judgment decision of voting.
Right, absolutely. And we always hear conscience is supreme, etc. But we know from Newman, it's an informed conscience. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that the church teaches one thing and the guy next door believes another and I'll decide between those two which one makes more sense for me. That's not how it works. Yeah. Our presumption always has to be that the thought of the ages, the teaching of our Lord as sifted by the church he created, 2,000 years of the greatest minds in the world, have thought about these things, and that is really how I should be forming how I view everything. And even at some times, even if it's not clear to me totally why, in fact, the church is right, I should always err on the side of thinking, but the church is going to be right because that's what it teaches. And if I don't see it right now, I'll probably find out along the way it does. And one of the great insights I had as a person who was kind of floating along as a generic Catholic for a long time is like, and in listening to Protestant radio and different things, is the unique thing of the Catholic Church is that it all fits together.
Right.
Over a period of time, all the pieces drop into place, even if you don't understand initially why they do. And so you have to form your conscience on what the church is teaching. Exactly, and not with this idea of, and I know you're talking to an earlier guest at one time about the idea of, you know, my truth and your truth.
Right, right.
No, Jesus Christ is the truth. That's, you know, Pontius Pilate might have been kidding around, but he didn't realize what he was asking.
Sorry, I'm cranky. That's right. And I wish we could that argument would carry as much weight as it does in this conversation as I wish it did in the public sphere. Because really, when people say your truth, my truth is my truth, and whatever relativistic ideal is trying to be pushed forth, ultimately what we're effectively saying is, therefore, nothing is true. And so Pontius Pilate's question is our question today, and you and I know that person is Jesus Christ, who is the truth.
Well, one time years ago, a priest who was on EW10 told the story. He was talking to a religious sister and disagreeing about something inside the church. And the sister said, well, as Jesus said, after all, what is truth? And he said, no, that was what Pontius Pilate said, sister. I'm sorry. That's the idea. We have the truth. Mother Angelica always said the same thing on EW10, and we're talking in an election period. We don't have debates. We know what the truth is. Mm-hmm. The church has shown us what the truth is. Our job is to stand up for that. And our job is to look at the candidates out there and evaluate based on an informed conscience and what the church puts out, etc., and to understand what are the major issues and decide many times that I, you know, this person or that person, they're not perfect,
yep,
but we don't want to make the perfect the enemy of the good.
Right.
So we have to at least go, because if, you know, in many cases, if you don't vote, you're voting for the person you don't want to get in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And whether you like it or not. And sometimes you can't vote for a person, but then you should look and say, I'm going to vote against that other person because that particular person is so heinous, or their belief system. And I think it's fair. And unfortunately, so many people don't get the truth. But if you really understand the issues, there's a stark contrast between a secularized Christianity approach that we wish was more Christian, mm-hmm, versus a virtually almost a culture of death kind of approach to things.
Yep.
And it's a stark contrast. And unfortunately, the media has done a very good job, the mainstream media, that is, of muddying up those things and hiding these things. And what so many people have to think about is so many things you were told over the last 4 years that this thing wasn't true or that thing wasn't true or they made this up. And it turns out later, guess what? These particular hoaxes, the Russian mm-hmm hoax or the laptop hoax or these other hoaxes, turned out to actually not be true. In which case, somebody in the mainstream media was telling you something that wasn't true.
Right.
You can't trust everybody. That's why you have Catholic radio. That's why you have this show. That's why you have News Nightly and the world over and the Register and CNA. And that's why there's other resources that are out there. Yep. And as people become more comfortable with using the web, they'll access those resources. And it's putting pressure on the mainstream media where they can't just bottle up their version of the truth and tell people this is what it is. People need to be informed so they can make an informed decision. That's why we have free choice. That's yes, why God doesn't force us to do anything.
Doug, thank you so much. I greatly, greatly enjoyed this conversation. God bless you.
Thank you.
My guest, Doug Keck, President and COO of EWTN, and we've been talking about our Catholic moral responsibility in performing our civic duty. Now, in this case, I want to extend that a little more and say we have an obligation to vote, a moral obligation to transform the culture, and voting is one way we do that. Stay tuned for the rest of the hour. I'm Marcus Peter.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
Hello, I'm Marian Kuharski, the director of Pro-Life Across America. We're non-political and totally educational. We don't scream or scold. Instead, we help people working through unplanned pregnancies know their options, and we rely on people like you to help with our mission. Check us out on Facebook, YouTube, or at ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. For many of us who listened to Cresta in the afternoon, Rita Marker, who was one of the most noteworthy anti-assisted suicide champions, she was a guest on Cresta in the afternoon. She passed away at age 83. She was a great anti-euthanasia warrior. And after a long illness, she passed on. And we look forward to having a conversation with a friend of mine soon about Rita, but I want to highlight a couple of things about Rita. Rita Marker was not the most sanguine individual. She did not set out to be in public. She, in fact, didn't even clamor for a public persona. She didn't even think she was going to be a public policy activist at all. She wasn't interested in notoriety. She didn't desire any fame. But she was an effective individual. She saw issues for what they were, and she saw a need to combat this particular issue and gave her life for it. And she did so with tremendous personal sacrifice. She was in Europe somewhere in the mid-1980s. Out of curiosity, there was a convention, which was an international right to die convention. She was so alarmed by the notion of a right to die convention that she and her late husband, who was alive at that time, Mike Marker, they attended the convention and they were floored by what they heard and saw. And please pardon me for chuckling, but it's the sheer ludicrousness of this movement that has permeated the culture now that warrants almost a kind of divine comedy. And joining me to talk about this is my friend Wes Smith, who is the chair and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. And Wes knew Rita. Wes, thank you for joining us, brother. How are you?
Rita was my mentor.
Wes, so, okay, let's start personal. How you knew her well. How impactful was she to the work that you are doing today?
How do I not exaggerate or get too hyperbolic? She was the person who dragged me kicking and screaming into this. Here's how it came down. I was writing books with Ralph Nader, and I was very happy. I mean, Ralph Nader had been my hero when I was in high school, and I couldn't believe that I actually became a co-author with Ralph. He and I wrote four books. And when we were working on the last book, it turns out that we wrote together, a friend of mine committed suicide under the influence of the Hemlock Society. And I was so upset about it that I wrote a piece for Newsweek magazine called The Whispers of Strangers, which came out in June of 1993. It's available on the internet if people want to read it. And a little while after that, I got a text, a fax. Remember the old thermal faxes where they would scroll out? Well, I was working on the last book I wrote with Ralph, and the fax went off, and it was a group called the International Anti-Euthanasia Task Force, which I had not heard of, asking permission to run that piece in their newsletter. I called them immediately before it was out of the fax machine, because I'd received so much hate mail. I was really shook. I thought, what happened to my culture, and where was I when it happened? And I talked to Rita Marker, and I said, hello, do you know what these people are thinking? And she said, yes, Wesley, I know. I said, are you aware of how they... She said, yes, Wesley, I know. And she sent me her book, Deadly Compassion.
Oh.
Deadly Compassion is a book about Anne Humphrey's death. Anne Humphrey was the wife of Derek Humphrey. She co-founded the Hemlock Society with Derek. And when she got breast cancer, he abandoned her. And then the movement turned their backs on her, and she was in despair. And who did she turn to? The old enemy, Rita Marker. And Rita brought her in and suckered her and was a friend to her. And eventually the darkness caught up with Anne Humphrey, and she killed herself, telling Rita, because she turned against the euthanasia movement, do your best, which Rita always did. Well, when I read Deadly Compassion, I was so stunned at the agenda that was being promoted. This is, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, that I called Rita and I said, I've got some skills you might make use of. I do media, you know, I'm on television, I'm an author. And she swooped in. And I said, I'll give you 10% of my time. And she would send me, this is before the internet, and her staff, packets of every two or three days I get these manila envelopes filled with clippings. And she was basically getting me up to speed about this movement and what was going on. And pretty soon it was 20%, then it was 30%, then I was giving her 50%. And she started putting me on the radio kind of as the voice of the task force. Eventually, Ralph said, Wesley, why are you doing the euthanasia work so much? And I told him, he said, you're absolutely right, and basically said, he didn't use these words, vaya con Dios. And I kind of, unexpectedly for me, moved away from working with Ralph, we're still friends and so forth, and started working this issue full time. And it led to me writing Forced Exit, Culture of Death, and other things. And Rita was always there to kind of steer me in the right direction and the way to argue about these issues. And let me tell your audience something about Rita. She didn't care about being well-known and famous.
Yep.
She may be the most effective public activist on these issues I've ever met. In fact, she is. She had stage fright and yet gave thousands and thousands and thousands of speeches all around the world. She was terrified of flying, yet flew all over the world to further the cause. She and Ralph are the two of the smartest people I've ever met. And she decided that the best way to help fight euthanasia and serve the needs of the task force was for her to become a lawyer.
Yep.
So she went to a mail-order kind of law school while still doing more than full-time work with the task force, graduated and passed the California bar exam, which is the hardest bar exam in the country, on the first try, and became a lawyer. She wrote legal documents. She worked behind the scenes with nursing homes and with nuns and so forth. She was remarkable, and she was always pushing me out front as kind of somebody who is, I guess, more acclimated to doing that kind of advocacy media stuff. But she was, Marcus, the most selfless, dedicated advocacy for righteousness that I've ever met.
You know, Wes, I'm glad you mentioned Deadly Compassion, because I have a copy of it on my table right now, and I was actually looking through it thinking about this interview, and I landed on page 225. I've not been able to get past it because of just how gut-wrenchingly moving. It has to do with Anne's death. This was when Rita found out about Anne's death, and so she quoted Thomas Hood, take her up tenderly, lift her with care, fashioned so slenderly, young and so fair. Take her up instantly, loving, not loathing. All that remains of her now is pure womanly. And like you mentioned, Anne was at one point perhaps one of the most significant adversaries to Rita's work. And yet all Rita could do was remember her in fond friendship and deep love. And this chapter is just gut-wrenchingly moving. And yes, this from so prolifically influential a woman who sought no fame for herself.
Yes. And Anne raised seven children, 29, she has 29 grandchildren, and I think 13 great-grandchildren. And, the International Anti-Euthanasia Task Force has renamed the Patients' Rights Council. And she just gave everything she had. She would skip paychecks because, the euthanasia movement is funded by people like George Soros. Millions of dollars go into that movement. The task force was funded by smaller donations and smaller grants. And sometimes finances got a little iffy. And Rita never stopped to think, oh, I need my paycheck. She just kept going even when the paycheck had to be skipped.
Wes, thank you. Thank you so much for making the time to speak with someone you respect and love dearly.
Thank you for talking about her, because she was a great woman that too many people don't know.
Oh, well, we'll make sure we can spread the word about her work. My guest, Wes Smith, Chair and Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. We've been talking about the passing of Rita Marcus. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
We are the pro-life generation, passionate about building the culture of life in our healthcare and in our nation. But not all healthcare options are equally pro-life, and some provide morally objectionable procedures. CMF Curo is different. CMF Curo is a pro-life Catholic healthcare ministry providing a pathway for its members to build the culture of life in their healthcare choices, not destroy it. Learn more about CMF Curo at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
The following program is brought to you in part by mycatholicwill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At mycatholicwill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. mycatholicwill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. mycatholicwill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu. The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jingle.
How might we understand the normal ups and downs of the spiritual life? In the eighth rule of St. Ignatius of Loyola's 14 Rules for the Discernment of Spirits, St. Ignatius highlights a normal pattern found within common spiritual experience, the alternation between spiritual desolation and spiritual consolation within the human heart. Describing the experience of spiritual desolation giving way to an experience of spiritual consolation, St. Ignatius taught, Let one who is in desolation work to be in patience, which is contrary to the vexations which come to him, and let him think he will soon be consoled. Father Timothy Gallagher writes, "For Ignatius, the ongoing alternation of these two spiritual movements is a normal pattern of every spiritual life. Neither spiritual consolation nor spiritual desolation lasts forever. Each will eventually give way to the other."
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. St. John the Apostle records the John chapter 6 Bread of Life discourse, in which Jesus states that his flesh is true food and his blood true drink. Who better to understand John's writings and subsequent teachings than a disciple and student of John, St. Ignatius of Antioch? In his letter to the Smyrnians in 110 AD, Ignatius writes, "I have no taste for corruptible food, nor for the pleasures of this life. I desire the bread of God, which is the flesh of Jesus Christ. And for drink, I desire his blood, which is love incorruptible." The Catholic Church absolutely follows St. John and St. Ignatius in taking Jesus at his word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. With the abortion debate in full flower, particularly during this election season, now is a good time to revisit certain core questions, one of which is, who were the influential opinion makers who sold abortion on demand to the United States government, radical feminists, and the American people? How did they do it? We're joined by Sue Ellen Browder to talk about the history of the movement and some of its driving forces. Sue has won 8 investigative medical journalism awards, including the Project Censored Award, which is also sometimes called the Alternative Pulitzer Prize, for news that didn't make the news about deadly doctors. For more than 30 years now, she's been involved in anywhere from pro-life movement to authoring articles for corporate press, and she is the author of Subverted, How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement. Sue, it's a real joy to speak with you. How are you?
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, I'd like to talk about the advertising campaign that sold abortion to the U.S. And really, I'm going to start with going as far back as we can just to develop a historical chain here. Instinctually, mothers love their babies. This has been one of the core driving instincts behind the flourishing of national populations across human history. So how did ad campaigns switch it such that today it's virtually unthinkable to talk about women becoming mothers naturally without this narrative of freedom of choice for the body?
Well, you're asking a question there, a feminist question, which is going to go beyond what I originally started this article with. Okay, this article started with a campaign mm-hmm. in the 1950s and 1960s by Hugh Moore, who was the inventor of the Dixie Cup.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and he thought a baby was as disposable as a Dixie Cup. And he thought that we would have to, we could avoid World War III if we had birth control and abortion.
Right. He's the author of The Population Bomb, right?
He was the author of a publication called The Population Bomb. And then Paul Ehrlich, who is much more famous than Hugh Moore was,
mm-hmm.
Paul Ehrlich borrowed that same title for his book called The Population Bomb,
right.
And that sold millions of copies. And convinced people don't remember that. See, I've been around. I'm old, so I've been around since the 1960s. And people don't remember that in those days, people were very frightened of World War III. Well, we still are. And Hugh Moore was saying that you can stop World War III if you kill all the babies that are of the poor people all around the world. He thought that we were all going to starve to death.
That's right.
And all of these starving people were somehow going to cause World War III. I don't quite know how he'd thought that, but there were lots of people that went along with it.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually ran campaigns, full page ads in the New York Times, many, many publications, with pictures of babies saying threat to peace.
Right.
Threat to peace. And so then, okay, so one of Hugh Moore's friends, and actually a co-worker, Larry Leder, who was the co-founder of the National Abortion Rights Action League, which is now a NARA, Pro-Choice America, worked with Hugh Moore. And in fact, he was, it doesn't say this in this article that I wrote, but he was one of his executive directors at one point. And this is what Larry Leder said. He said we were breeding ourselves to death. And this is what he said about Hugh Moore's pamphlet. The booklet's whiplash phraseology stung a dormant public, and its relentless parade of facts and figures about booming birth rates, looming famines, zooming taxes, all likely to breed war, made uncomfortable but compelling reading.
Yeah.
It is now recognized, he said, that we must reduce birth rates or await the inevitable disaster. We are on the way to breeding ourselves to death.
The sheer ignorance.
That sounds crazy today.
Crazy is an understatement, to be sure, but this isn't even a question of antiquated science here. A lot of these statistics and quote-unquote facts were fabricated.
That's right.
And they've been disproven. It's not that we have insufficient resources for the amount of people we have on the planet, but this was the narrative that later latched onto from Moore, and so they spearheaded the movement forward.
Yes, but then now you ask, okay, so how did they convince women to dive into this? Well, Larry Leder was friends with Betty Friedan.
Right.
Betty Friedan was the founder of the second wave feminism with her book, her 1963 book, The Feminine Mystique.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the first president of the National Organization for Women. And Larry Leder, they were both magazine writers who worked together, and Larry Leder convinced her that women needed abortion to be inserted into the women's movement so that women could be free. Now, you have to remember, this was a time in the 1960s that women were being fired for being pregnant. I was fired for being pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of women bought into this. So we said, well, yeah, we've got, in fact, okay, I had an abortion because I had two children. I was working. I was making a living with my husband. We were poor writers. And I got pregnant with a third child by mistake, by surprise. And we were stuck between a rock and a hard place, you know, at that time. It was right after Roe v. Wade, and I was not Catholic. I did not understand that human beings are immortal and eternal. I did not understand any of that. I was scared. I was young. I didn't want to be fired again for being pregnant, and so I had an abortion. Well, this was because Betty Friedan, at that time, all the women's movements were saying, you know, oh, you've got to have this. It's going to set you free.
Right,
it was
right.
The worst mistake of my life. Do not do this ever, ladies. And this vote that we've got coming up for this election, it's very essential who you vote for on this, because anybody who is fighting for abortion, which Kamala Harris is a very dangerous person.
So,
sorry to say that, but
no. I'm thinking about your comments about Betty Friedan. One of the things that she did so successfully with the Feminine Mystique, it baffles me that it achieved the success that it did, because she convinced virtually every woman, not just in America, but on the planet, but at least in the Western Hemisphere, that they had been, up till that point, so you're talking about almost 2,000 years, completely dissatisfied with life, and that this narrative that she was presenting was finally going to set women free. And that's just 2,000 years of, you know, like modern history since Christianity. So her claim is ludicrous from the outset, and yet it was completely bought hook, line, and sinker. It made the waves. It challenged the fundamental framework and foundational principles of society and culture. And it was terrible that it did.
she did not include abortion in her feminine mystique.
Right.
It was men that convinced her to insert abortion in the women's movement.
Mm-hmm.
And then we know exactly the night that it happened. On November 18th, 1967, in the Chinese room of the Mayflower Hotel, they had a meeting, the second annual meeting of the National Organization for Women. And that night, only 57 people. They had 103 to 105 people at that convention. So it's a small group, 103 to 105 people. Only 57 people voted to insert abortion into the women's movement that night, into the list of the NOW's Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And one-third of those women walked out and later resigned from NOW over the abortion vote. We've been fighting over this since 1967 and even before that.
Yeah.
And when Roe v. Wade was decided, that was not a political decision. That was a legal decision.
Mm-hmm.
That court case was not correct. It wasn't correct.
Yeah, it was bad law. We will continue this conversation with Sue on the other side of the break. My guest is Sue Ellen Browder, who has been a prolific voice for true women's rights and the right to life, but she's also the author of Subverted, How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is sponsored by Workforce Pay Hub, providing payroll, time tracking, HR management, and benefits administration, all with a dedicated customer-centric service team. More information can be found at workforcepayhub.com.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
I've seen the difference in my son since he's been at Ave Maria. He's happy, he's excited about what he's going to do with his degree, and he's living his faith.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu. Get detailed descriptions of Ave Maria Radio guests on their website, avemariaradio.net. Go to the archives, find your favorite program, and then find links or books mentioned in that program. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Did you know my mom's gonna have a baby? We heard the heartbeat, and my dad said this is gonna be someone very special.
Hello, my name is Marianne Koharski. I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America. We hope you'll consider supporting the work of Pro-Life Across America. Your gift will help offer life-saving alternatives to those in need. Visit our website at ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org or like us on Facebook.
Pro-Life Across America, the billboard people.
What does the Ninth Commandment forbid? The Catholic Catechism says the Ninth Commandment warns against carnal concupiscence, sins against the flesh. What is concupiscence? It is the consequence of original sin. Though baptism purifies the soul of all sin, it does not remove our tendency toward sin. In this rebellion of the flesh against the spirit, as defined by St. Paul, we must develop purity of heart, the desire always to do the will of God, especially in the area of charity and chastity. Purity requires modesty. Modesty protects the intimate center of a person. It refuses to unveil what should be hidden. Modesty guides how you look at others and behave toward them. It should dictate one's choice of clothing so as not to exploit or tempt another. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Christ is the Answer with Father John Ricardo.
John chapter 11, verses 21 to 26. This is the story of Lazarus. Lazarus has died. Lazarus is one of his best friends. Just before this passage, we hear the news that Martha and Mary send word to Jesus that the one you love is sick. And the next line in the scripture is, now because Jesus loved Martha and Mary and Lazarus, he stayed where he was. His friend's in need. He can heal. They've seen him heal before. And yet somehow, because he loves him, he stays. And Lazarus dies. And then Jesus shows up 3 days later and is greeted by Martha and Mary, who confront him with the words, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would never have died. Rather applicable for many of us in our lives. We ask the Lord to do one thing because we're certain it is what we think is best, when in fact he has something which far surpasses what we ask for. Challenge is, in waiting for that to happen, we go through very trying times, which oftentimes makes us wonder, does he really care?
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, prolific author and speaker for Life and the True Dignity of Women, Sue Ellen Browder, author of Subverted, How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement. And we're talking about the advertising campaign that sold abortion to the United States of America. Now, Sue, we were talking earlier, and you know, in the interest of not naming particular candidates, what we can talk about is that the attempt to want to re-enshrine Roe versus Wade is nothing short of re-cementing murder into the natural operations of our nation. And
that's right.
So I want to kind of open there, but let's pick up where we left off, which is, you were talking about Layden and Moore partnering together and creating this ad campaign, convincing Betty Friedan to espouse abortion as part of a movement. You've got Helen Gurley Brown thrown into the mix there. And in this entire cacophony, with this myriad of confusing and frankly deceitful narratives thrown at women, you see that opinions start changing about women and how they think of themselves and their role in society.
That's right. That's right. It was a group of very powerful elite people who were promoting this. And yes, that's exactly right. Women's minds changed, and they don't know how this all started.
Yeah. And so let's talk about, for example, throughout the 1950s, right, you highlight this, Martin Lasky reported on this, that Moore's public relations strategy, it was tremendously successful because the anti-abortion movement was not as prominent as it is today. And yet,
that's right.
The pro-abortion movement jumped on that.
That's right. Pro-abortionists had a field day because Christians were not thinking about this. All the laws were in every state were against abortion, and they thought that was just a settled law. But the American lawyers began to defend to say our laws needed to be changed. And the American Law Institute in 1962 advocated changing state abortion laws. Why? Not to protect women, but to shield doctors from liability.
Mm-hmm.
Because the IUD, the intrauterine device, mm-hmm. was becoming very popular at that time, and in some cases it could cause abortions.
Right. In fact, very often it is an abortifacient.
Right. Right. So the American Law Institute, to protect the lawyers, said that they should change those state laws. And that was one of the beginnings. And that, again, this was part of this huge campaign. You have to remember, I'm a journalist, and I wrote for Cosmopolitan for many years, too. Mm-hmm. The advertisers control the what is written in newspapers,
right,
and the magazines a lot of times. So with these great big full-page ads in the New York Times, pretty soon what you've got is the New York Times advocating abortion.
Yeah.
Why? Because that's where the money's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
You have to follow the money.
And it's one of the first things they teach you in J school. I went through a big part of my undergraduate was in journalism, and following the money is one of the key things to writing a good story and testing the veracity of it. So, you know, these terror-promoting headlines, they're taking out full-page ads in the New York Times, all of them to the effect of the population bomb is going to destroy the world and abortion is the only solution.
Right. Birth control and abortion. Mm-hmm. See, abortion was a backup for birth control because birth control is not 100% effective. So that was they wanted abortion as a backup.
Yeah.
And then they wanted to, John D. Rockefeller III was involved in this too with all of his money. And he funded Catholics for a Free Choice. He was one of the funders for Catholics for a Free Choice. One thing they did was they wanted to split Christians. They blamed Catholics for it. They blamed the hierarchy. Not the little lower Catholics like you and me, but the hierarchy,
mm-hmm.
and those are the bad guys, and so they split, and Christians, both Protestants and Catholics, and there were even articles written in the Reader's Digest. Larry later wrote an article in the Reader's Digest and said Protestants are so much more advanced than Catholics are, on this issue. Well, okay. And so they split Christians off. They split Catholics off from their bishops and their priests, and they split Protestants off from Catholics. They divided us, and then they won.
Yeah, and they won, and then they eventually received the support of, because like you mentioned, later realized that there was no way the movement was going to get traction from these ideas into the streets, into getting women actually acting on it without Free Dan. And then eventually every other feminist individual who mobilized their supporters, and you've got the founder of Planned Parenthood who joins the foray as well eventually.
That's right. So it was, you know, later did say, because we've all heard of Dr. Bernard Nathanson,
mm-hmm.
who claimed responsibility for 75,000 abortions before he became pro-life, realized, you know, he saw babies on a fetal monitor and he realized those were human beings. It was later that talked to Dr. Bernard Nathanson and said, we've got to recruit the feminists.
Yeah.
We've got to get this out into the streets.
Yep.
And he sure did it. We don't know exactly what he said to her. But 6 weeks after he said, we have to recruit the feminists, Betty Friedan stood up in that meeting and rammed through the abortion road, and that's when abortion became a so-called right for women.
And so in 73, for example, this was a year after the Rockefeller report came out,
mm-hmm.
you get judges, church-going Methodists, conservative Republicans, also falling into this narrative of the population control. It becomes this narrative trap that the entire world is embracing. It went global. It wasn't just here in the United States. It went global. In fact, my own education up till high school was on the tail end of receiving that particular brand of science, that population control was the only way to go. So,
mm-hmm.
So in the face of all of this, really, the concept of human dignity, the dignity of the human person as divinely endowed, it took a global hit, and it took a historical hit. This went on for decades.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And also, the politicians behind the scenes began to realize that abortion was a cheap way to save money, to reduce the rising costs of welfare.
Mm-hmm.
And the first year after Roe v. Wade, it was reported to Congress that they had saved at least $500 million in 1973 dollars by funding abortions instead of childbirth.
Right. And what's not mentioned in this, too, is, like you mentioned, women were being fired for being pregnant. Procuring abortions meant that women would continue to be, in this case, indentured servants of the workforce, working for the very men that otherwise would have fired them and serving them in their physical desires.
Well, that's right. Judge John Noonan, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he was a Ninth Circuit Court judge, said, in the abortion world, it was not strange that a rich man should tell a poor man,
yep.
I'd love to help you. Let me show you how to kill your unborn children.
Yeah, John Noonan Jr. And yeah, that was a that's an alarming statement to come out of
a court
justice. Yeah.
I'd love to help you.
And that's the thing, right? That help now has been defined as, I'm going to stop you from procreating. I'm going to stop you from bringing new life into the world. And now, on the tail end of this horrendous narrative, we're suffering from a population crisis. We're barely at replacement rate. We're under replacement rate, actually. And a lot of our government structures that they bemoaned would suffer because, if we didn't have abortion, are now suffering because we had abortion.
Well, that's right, because it was a foolish notion from the beginning. Breeding ourselves to death? Really? You know, it was based on fear. It's all based on fear.
Yeah.
It's not based on love. It's based on fear.
The entirety of, just to step back on a grand scale, Sue, you're a journalist and you're well aware of societal currents. You think about Nietzsche, Marx, and the kind of utopia that's promised, right? If you break yourself from the hierarchical structure and systems that anywhere from the patriarchy to the Catholic Church institutes, and it promised, atheism promised us, you know, Dawkins and his ilk promised us a liberated society, one that would be flourishing beyond compare. And yet all we have to show for it is misery. We have prosperity, to be sure, technological advancements, but we have a dwindling population. Our advancement is nowhere near as fast as it used to be. And worst of all, marriage, the family, and society at large is suffering. Our economy is suffering. So for all these promises, what do they have to show for it?
That's right. No, that's right. A healthy economy is a growing economy.
Mm-hmm.
If you eliminate the people, you don't have any consumers left either.
Yeah.
You know, a baby is not a Dixie cup, but Hugh Moore thought he was.
Yeah. And here we are paying the price for it. So this was as much a pernicious movement as well as an ad campaign that was meant to line the pockets of those involved at the time. And we're paying the price for it. And one would hope that this conversation has aided our listeners in having their eyes open and their hearts changed. Do you have anything to say to especially women listening right now?
Well, I think I said it earlier that women need to realize that this was not for women.
Yeah.
This was against women. This is anti-women's lib. And women are beginning to wake up, especially young women are beginning to wake up and realize that.
Sue, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us. God bless you.
Thank you so much.
My guest, Sue Ellen Browder, author of Subverted, How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I would urge you to share that episode, especially that particular conversation with Sue, with friends, family, and anyone who needs to know the history of this movement of abortion in the United States. Until next time, for Ave Maria in the Afternoon, I'm Marcus Peter.